Well, first of all, thank you all for having me here today. I did not go to Cornell. I went to a small liberal arts college in central New Jersey, some of you might be familiar with, almost as good as Cornell. So, I thought Andrew was so inspiring. And I want to try to inspire you in a different way, which is once you're running a company, once you've started something, how do you think about culture? How do you think about building not just the business, but the company? And I want to start with a little bit of a caveat. And I want to talk about fig wasps for a minute. So how many people have eaten figs before? Of the Newton variety or the regular, right? So what you might not know is that there's something on the order of 900 different types of fig trees. So a fig is not a fig is not a fig. 900 different types of fig trees. And you might not notice the difference looking at them, and you might not notice the difference eating them. But if you were a fig wasp, which is the vehicle for pollination in fig trees, you would notice the difference because you would only be attracted to one of the 900 types. So to the outside world, they all look alike. But to a fig wasp, they're all different, and only one of them works. And that's a little bit how I think about building a culture of a company. There's no right answer, but certain people will be attracted to certain cultures. And culture is one of those things that I think is a little bit the way Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart described pornography in the 70s, which is, I'm not sure I can tell you what it is, but I know it when I see it. And a company's culture is a little bit like that. I know hundreds of technology companies, and I know hundreds of companies that are in the digital marketing and email space, which is like ReturnPath. And I can tell you within 30 seconds of walking in the door of one of those companies whether I would click with the culture or not. So culture is something that's very important, that's near and dear to my heart, and that has a lot to do with the ReturnPath story. And the way I'd love for you all to think about your job as an entrepreneur or as a CEO is that not just to build a great company or a great culture, but to think about how to disrupt the workforce. And what I mean by that is innovate. So in the startup world, you're constantly thinking about innovation and disruption, right? That's what you're starting something to do, odds are. You want to disrupt an industry. You want to innovate a business process. You want to innovate for customers. But a lot of people don't think about innovating culture and innovating for people and disrupting the workforce. And yeah, if you think about it, most company structures and policies and cultures have kind of been the same way for hundreds of years. Companies were designed to kind of control workers and closely manage output of physical goods a couple hundred years ago. And it's time to disrupt that. So what I want to talk about first are a few reasons to disrupt culture, which will be quick, and then a bunch of ideas for how to disrupt the workforce, a few enablers for it, and then a couple of proof points. So why do you want to disrupt the workforce? Well, fundamentally, workplaces are as dynamic as ever, right? They're more collaborative, more remote, more global, more demanding. At the same time, most employees are less loyal and feel more entitled. So the workplace is something that is ripe for disruption. You also, as an entrepreneur, always want to play offense. Building a great culture and engendering more loyalty, having people stay longer, build their careers with you, do great things for you, go the extra mile, is good business. It's just smart. But if you don't believe in offense, at least you should believe in defense, which is that if you don't disrupt the workplace, other people will disrupt yours. And it's not just Google. And it's not just about providing good perks or serving lunch every day. So let me share with you 7 things from the Return Path playbook over the last 15 years that we've done to disrupt the workforce. Number one, kill your expense policy. How do most companies structure expense policies? Right, if you've ever worked at any mature organization, the expense policy is usually a couple pages long. It's got a lot of rules in it. I remember the first one I had at the management consulting firm I worked at after college, only because Venture for America wasn't around. We were able to spend X amount of dollars on breakfast, X on dinner, X on lunch. Those would change if we were taking out a client or doing something internal. When we stayed at a hotel for business travel, there was a threshold that we could spend, and that varied by city. Really complicated expense policy. And most companies have expense policies like that. The problem with those expense policies is, A, they're incredibly complicated and hard to monitor. And B, it's not clear what you get as a company by having one of those. You're, you know, trying to control the workforce. The CEO I worked for in the job before I started Return Path in the mid-90s, the CFO scrutinized every line on everyone's expense report and literally wouldn't pay something that was out of policy. If you spent $152 on a hotel and policy for that city was $150, you would get $150 back. So when we started Return Path, we had a real expense policy. And then one day I just said, you know, this is nonsense. I trust my employees. I have smart people who work here. So our expense policy now is 4 words: use your best judgment. And you know what our expenses are per person on the other side of that policy change? Exactly what they were before. Actually, they're a little lower. Another good way to disrupt the workforce is give people unlimited vacation or create a sabbatical program. These are different things. But this is another one of those things. If you think about what the typical company does for vacation policy, it's kind of like expenses. You're allowed to take 12 business days off per year. You can have 2 floating holidays. I've never been quite sure what the difference is between those two. And you can have 4 sick days. I love limiting sick days. That's awesome. And you know, the theory I had about this one at some point, and when we started the company, we had a normal vacation policy. We did 3 weeks, unlimited sick days, but normal policy. Use it or lose it, you know, accrue it on the balance sheet, all of that stuff. And I realized at some point that the lines between people's work lives and home lives have completely blurred. The distinction almost doesn't exist anymore. And if you don't count the hours that people are working, why should you count the hours that they're not working? Right? You expect people to check email on their smartphone, you know, off hours, respond to things. Why should you care if they have to go to the dentist in the middle of the day, stay home because the cable guy is coming, go to their kids' parent-teacher conference? So we blew up our vacation policy, went to unlimited vacation. The policy is you still have to ask and get it approved, but you can take as much as you want as long as you get your job done, as long as you meet your goals, as long as you meet your commitments to your colleagues. And what did we find with this? People take exactly as much vacation as they did before the policy change, but they're much happier about it. They feel trusted. They feel valued. They don't feel watched and counted. If you want an extra bonus, create a sabbatical program. Every 5 years, we let people take 6 weeks off to do whatever they want. And some of the stories from that are amazing. So first of all, it's a great retention tool. You get someone at 3.5 years, and they start thinking about what they're going to do. And they come back completely energized and refreshed and ready to go for the next few years. My favorite sabbatical story was a woman here in our New York office who went to JFK with a backpack, an around-the-world ticket, a Lonely Planet guide to the Earth, and a bunch of money. She sent us about 20 postcards from different places around the world and came back ready to go. Another good way to disrupt the workplace is to share everything. People talk a lot about transparency these days, and transparency really is critical. And again, it's a sign of trust, right? If you trust the people in your organization to understand your strategy at a deep level, to understand your financials every month, to understand the scary things like your cash position and how you might be running out of it. People appreciate the trust. It's harder on you as a leader, as an entrepreneur, but the rewards are great from your people being engaged. Feedback is another area ripe for disruption. So how does feedback usually work in a big organization? Once a year, you get a long-form written review from your boss. The boss hates it because you're the boss. You got to write 8 reviews at once, covering 12 months of work. You can't remember what happened 12 months ago. And you deliver it to the employee, and there's some kind of awkward conversation, and that's the end of it. We'd like to give feedback continuously. We have a structured process once a quarter, but it actually happens a lot more frequently than that. We do 360s, so you get feedback from all around the organization. We do them live. So when I have my 360, it's my board and my executive team sitting in a room with a moderator talking about me, and I'm in the room too. So figuring out how to make feedback not a scary thing, but just a part of work and a part of development is a great way to disrupt things. Move people around a lot. I can't remember who coined this phrase. I think it might have been Sheryl Sandberg in Lean In, that it used to be that building your career was like climbing a ladder. And now building a career is like climbing on a jungle gym. Sometimes you go up, sometimes you go sideways. Sometimes you might go down. We have found over time that high performers and smart knowledge workers are not necessarily interested in their boss's job. I'll come back to this theme in a minute. But sometimes they want to try something new. And being able to move people around laterally in your organization and think about career pathing in non-traditional ways is hugely, hugely important. Every year, we move about 15% of our workforce up and 15% of our workforce around. So we do just as much lateral as we do promotion. And what we find is super high performers don't get bored, they keep engaged. And the medium performers, you know, the good, solid performers, who may never get promoted, still get to try something new. And they get to add value to the new function by bringing the domain expertise and the functional expertise they have from the last function. Speaking of which, who knows about the Peter Principle? The Peter Principle is that ultimately, as organizations age and get bigger, they run into trouble because everyone gets promoted to their level of incompetence. So if you think about that, right? If you're good, you keep getting promoted until you stop getting promoted. And you stop getting promoted because you're not good anymore. But you're probably not bad enough to fire. So lots of organizations historically have been stuck with workforces of people who aren't really doing great jobs anymore. You can't really promote them. You can't really fire them. And we've been trapped by this as well over time. Right? We have made promotions knowing that the person wasn't going to work out because we felt like we didn't have a choice. And we stopped doing that. So now what we do is we just pay them more. We try to give them more interesting work. This is particularly true in engineering and sales, where the skill set to be a good sales rep is really different from the skill set to be a good sales manager. But if we can keep them engaged, keep giving them new assignments within sales, keep paying more, again, same with engineering, we've done a good thing. Final way to disrupt the workforce is to be human. High performers like to be led, but they don't like leaders who put themselves on a pedestal. They don't like leaders who sit in the corner office, come out and bark orders. They want to be inspired. They want to be talked to personally. They want to know that you know their name, that you know their girlfriend's name or boyfriend's name or pet's name. You know what's meaningful to them. And you'd be surprised at your brain's capacity to hold that stuff if you work at it. I knew everyone's name in the company until probably 350 or 375 people. And I could still tell you spouses' names and pets' names for probably the first 100. You got to work at it. You got to have flashcards or build an internal app. But it makes a big difference. So let me talk about a few enablers. Right? 3 things you have to do to make this stuff happen. My favorite is ignore your investors. And I don't really mean ignore your investors. But I sort of mean ignore your investors. at least select your investors carefully. I had a slide in my first pitch deck in 2000 when I raised my first round, my Series A, that described our operating philosophy. And it was a people-first philosophy, and it still is today. We said people in the company are our most important constituency. Our job is to attract, retain, and grow the best talent. If we do that really well, we'll succeed with our second constituency, which is our customers, because we'll produce the best products for them and give them the best service. And if we get that right, then our third and least important constituency, shareholders, will benefit because we will have built a great business. And I had this in my VC pitch deck. And I said, if that philosophy doesn't work for you, if you want a shareholder-first organization, then don't invest. And some didn't. And that's fine, because I ended up with three great investors who've been around for the whole journey, last 14 plus years, who buy into that philosophy and who support it. But there's another challenge you have too, which is with your managers. You actually have to defy them, but you have to support them. Every time we've made one of those policy changes, we've blown up the vacation policy, blown up the expense policy, the people who get most nervous about it are managers. Why? The rules are in place to help them. Right? It's much easier to tell your employee, oh, well, you got to follow the rule because it's the rule, than it is to apply judgment and say, gosh, you know, it looks like that $900 dinner for three of you, well, that might have been a little much. Right? That's harder than saying, oh, out of policy. So you got to bring managers along for the ride, and you got to make sure that they know you have their back. Right? Unlimited vacation doesn't mean that people don't show up for work. They still have to ask. It just means that managers have to hold them accountable for good work. And that's sort of the last enabler, which is you got to raise the bar. There's a social contract with any organization, but particularly with startups. All of this good stuff that you get by being at a startup has to come in exchange for high performance. And that's a tricky thing that not all companies get right. So, most important question, does it work? Is it good business at the end of the day to disrupt the workforce, to care about a people-first environment? It's worked for us. We've won lots and lots of awards as an employer of choice, including about 2 months ago, Fortune Magazine, second best place to work in America, of mid-sized companies, small and mid-sized companies. I don't like to brag much, but I love that one. And that's a huge competitive advantage. It's a huge competitive advantage for any company, not just companies with knowledge workers, but for any company. And it's all about attracting and retaining talent. So we track a bunch of these metrics. These are important business metrics for us, just the same way we track, you know, contract value and EBITDA and everything else. In any given quarter, 25 to 50% of new employees are referred in by existing employees. So it helps with recruiting. As I said, we promote about 15% of our people every year and move laterally about another 15%. So about 30% of our workforce is getting a new challenge, a new assignment every year, growing their careers with us, building their careers. And turnover is great. It's low. Tenure is tremendous at my company. Our average tenure, including everybody, and we probably hired 130 people this year, average tenure is 3.5 years. Over 20% of our workforce is 5 years plus. We still have 40 of the first 100 employees from a 15-year-old company. And we're very proud of those things. So that's it. I think we're going to do some of the texting questions now. And I will leave you with one small plug, which is that we're going to hire probably 150 more people this year. And we love hiring entrepreneurial people. So you won't necessarily get to be the CEO, but you'll get to work in a great entrepreneurial organization and apprentice a little bit. So the best way to find me is actually not on LinkedIn, which people tend to want to do. And I try to keep LinkedIn to people that I actually know. But just email me at matt@returnpath.com if you want to connect. Thank you very much.
I think you're about to get 150 emails in your inbox. So before I go to those questions,
and I would say if you do email, put something in the subject line so I can reference it, like Cornell, heard you at Cornell or CU Summit. Yeah.
So I just have a question for you, which is I was recently talking to an entrepreneur that had pitched us, and he had pitched a bunch of venture capitalists and ultimately took an angel round. And he said to me, I found your feedback really helpful and all the other VCs, and I circulated those 20 rejection emails to my entire team. I hope you're okay with that. And it prompted this discussion about how transparent should you be. My knee-jerk was like, I think you're, you know, I said, they don't have the context. But it got me thinking, like, maybe it is the right thing. I'm curious your take about, like, just how transparent do you be? If you really have that level of, you know, negative feedback, or is there some stuff that you should kind of buffer from your organization, or is it just a totally transparent sort of culture?
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, you got to apply judgment like anything else. I would say, you know, we are nearly 100% transparent about business performance and strategy. Income statement, balance sheet go out every month to the company.
Every month.
Every board book goes out to the entire company. Wow. I'll redact something about a specific person's compensation. Comp is really the only thing that we're not transparent about around sort of the normal functioning of the business. The place where I curate a little bit, and I won't say I block, but I curate, are things like that, right? So if I'm pitching a round of financing, and at the end of the day, I'm gonna get one firm in and 30 firms are gonna pass along the way, I will share with the organization the learnings from the 30 that passed, but I'm not gonna tweet them in real time.
Right.
Right, because people do need that context, and they do need to be sort of appreciative of what they're hearing. There are other areas that are gray areas. Different entrepreneurs I know who have the same philosophy about transparency treat M&A very differently, for example. So when we're thinking about buying a company, we actually talk about it. The downside is when you don't do it, you have to come back and explain why. But you know, there's some CEOs that don't want to talk about M&A. We err on the side of sharing a little bit too much rather than sharing not enough.
Cool. So we'll go to the... share a key learning that relates to the discovery of the seven principles. Sort of when did you, you know, what have you learned along the way that fosters these principles?
You know, I learned a lot of them from the place that I worked before I started the company, which did the opposite of the seven principles. So I had a lot of experience working in an environment that didn't get it right. And I worked hard there, but every time the CEO came out of the corner office and barked at people using the wrong name and embarrassing them in front of their colleagues, I thought, you know, that is probably a better way to do this. But I'll give you a concrete story from that company around the expense policy one, which is kind of a fun one. So this is one of those companies where we had the 2 or 3 page expense policy and everything was documented, this many dollars per night at this hotel. So I travel to LA on business with the CEO, and I'm in coach, and he's in first. And then we get to LA, and I'm staying at the, you know, whatever hotel, and he's staying at the Peninsula. And I called him on it. I said, well, policy says X. And, he didn't really say anything. And about 3 weeks later, company issued a revised expense policy that had everything that it used to have before, and then a line at the end that said, essentially, CEO is exempt from expense policy. You got to play by the same rules that everyone else.
Yeah, sounds like you inspired the change in that expense reform. So I'll try to combine two questions, which I think are really good ones. One is, can you pivot to this model? It sounds like you sort of did a little bit along the way. So can you change as the company evolves? And does it hit a breaking point? You know, thousands of employees.
You can definitely change. Look, the whole concept that I have of disrupting the workforce, of innovating, is, you know, you're innovative in every function in the company. You can be innovative in HR. You can be innovative with policies. Our policies today are different than they were 15 years ago. And we take pride in evolving them. And now at involving the people in the company at helping us design the policies in ways that make sense. And then, sorry, what was the second part?
Does it cap?
Does it cap? I don't think it caps if you're willing to evolve them.
Right.
So, you know, we're 430, 450 people right now. And things are definitely different than they were when we were 25. There's no question about that. But I think, you know, we're a values-driven organization. Like, we have a bunch of value statements, but they actually mean something. We use them. They help us make decisions. And, you know, the culture can change, but the values of the organization really don't.
So you made this comment about you can walk into an organization in 30 seconds, feel the culture. There are a lot of college students putting in questions and over 100 in the audience. How do you go about picking a team if you want to start a business, if you're a prospective student or even alum ready to do a startup?
Very carefully. My motto when it comes to building a team is hire slow and fire fast. And yeah, particularly the first 10 employees, right, at a company are the ones that really help you establish the DNA of the organization. And you know, you want to interview them for functional competency, but you have to interview them for fit as well. And in fact, we define cultural fit as being a job competency. We don't think of it as something that's outside of whether you're capable of doing the job. Because if you're capable of doing the job but not capable of doing it here, then that's the same as not being capable of doing it. So interviewing thoroughly is critical. I mean, when you're small, you have everyone interview everyone. Even to this day, average candidate with us probably interviews with 10 people before they join. And I did a final interview on everyone until about 250 or 300 employees. No matter what they were interviewing for. They got short at the end. You know, I think the first year that we hired 100 people, I almost died. but even today, we make sure that one member of the executive team interviews every single finalist for every job and does that sort of last check on, you know, is this the kind of person that we want in the organization?
There's a question up here about a lot of early stage companies are in co-location facilities where there are other companies around. Furthermore, a lot are virtual with people all over the country or the world. How do you deal with culture in those cases?
Yeah, those are two pretty different cases.
Yeah.
I think I'm a big believer in flexibility and having people who work remote. I'm also a big believer that humans need to see each other periodically and that there are real limits to how much of a relationship you can build if you don't sit face-to-face with people. So I think in the case of having an organization that's virtual or remote, you do need to get that organization together in person, I would say at least 4 times a year. The book, Remote, which was written by the 37 Signals guys, and I'm a little bit mixed on the book, but it has some really good things in it, and that's one of them. They have a company that's largely remote, but everyone shows up in person quarterly. Co-working spaces are definitely tough, and we have a couple of our smaller offices are in co-working spaces, and you just have to create some of your own space. So if it's not going to be in the co-working space, then you know that team needs to they need to be you know connected to other offices by video, but B, that team needs its own, they need their own coffee shop or their own bar or someone's apartment that they can go to periodically, so they don't get completely kind of morphed into the blob of the co-working space.
Question about diversity. How does diversity fit into culture?
Diversity is really important, and it's pretty tricky. And it's tricky for a couple reasons. One is that now I'm talking about stuff that's more in the world that I'm in, right, which is sort of technology companies. The normal talent pool is skewed. Right, and whether it's skewed because of people's education or interests, or you know, as you're trying to hire more experienced people, you know, it skews for all kinds of reasons. So you have to work very, very hard to make sure that you're building a diverse workforce, and we work really, really hard at it. And the place to work hard at it is at candidate sourcing. It's not in the recruiting process, right? You don't want the organization to feel like you're quotaing, but you have to have a recruiting team that is excited about looking for candidates that are not everyday candidates. But it's definitely hard, no question about it, and controversial too. You know, because you always want to hire the best people for the job. You don't want to have that sort of thought pattern of like, oh, you know, the person's not quite as good, but I need one of those.
So thank you, Matt, for awesome, a lot of food for thought there on filling the pressure. Great job.
Absolutely, yeah.
Thanks, Matt.